Penguin Random House Audio presents Becoming Kim Jong-un, a former CIA officer's insights into North Korea's enigmatic young dictator. This is the author, Jung H. Pak. Prologue. Even by the standards of North Korea, consummate purveyor of propaganda, one could not have asked for better weather for the staging of Kim Jong-il's funeral on December 28, 2011. It was cold, bleak, and snowing. The white snow contrasted perfectly with the black of the hearse, the coffin atop it, and the mourner's attire, matching the melancholy in the people's hearts as they bade farewell to their beloved leader, who had ruled them since 1994, when the country's founder Kim Il-sung had died. As the funeral procession moved through the snow, the North Korean people lining the streets wept, fainted, and convulsed with grief, genuine or otherwise. Men and women, soldiers and workers, the young and the old, beat or clawed at their chests and clung to one another for comfort or pounded the ground in anguish. The roar of this collective demonstration of sorrow was deafening, and it probably stirred even those in the crowd who did not feel this passion for the dead leader who had ruled with an iron hand. Prominently leading the procession was the baby-faced Kim Jong-un, North Korea's new leader. He kept his composure, walking silently and mournfully, though his tense face and tears betrayed the real grief he must have felt. He was now, after all, an orphan. His mother had died of breast cancer when he was 20 years old. Kim Jong-il, the dictator, father, and movie impresario, would have been pleased with every aspect of this final production. Kim Jong-il's death on December 17, 2011, from overwork, as the North Korean state media described it, was not a surprise. Everyone knew that Kim had health issues. He had suffered a stroke in late 2008, and that the time would probably come when his family's history of heart disease and his days of smoking, drinking, and partying would catch up with him. His father, Kim Il-sung, had also died of a heart attack. Still, the death was jarring. At the time of the funeral, I was a relatively new analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, having begun my job there in early 2009, soon after Kim's stroke. When he had made his first public appearance at the rubber-stamp Supreme People's Assembly spring meeting, he was shockingly thin, his once plump cheeks now creppy and clinging to his prominent cheekbones. His gait was slow and measured. When Kim's death came, a palpable anxiety gripped the world. South Korea convened a National Security Council meeting as the country put its military and civil defense on high alert. Japan set up a crisis management team, and the White House issued a statement saying it was in close touch with their allies in South Korea and Japan. At CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, I remember being watchful for any indications of instability in Pyongyang as I began to develop my thinking about where North Korea might be headed under its youthful and inexperienced new leader. The North Korean regime was quick to dispel any doubt or confusion about its next ruler. The state media, after dutifully exalting Kim Jong-il's brilliant life and leadership and his role as the parent of the nation and a lodestar of the fatherland's reunification, immediately proclaimed that the future was secure under Kim Jong-un. At the head of our revolution today stands Comrade Kim Jong-un, the great successor. All of the party members, the men and officers of the People's Army, and the people should faithfully uphold the leadership of Comrade Kim Jong-un. They should firmly defend the single-hearted unity of the party, the army, and the people, and should further strengthen it like steel. The path for our revolution is arduous, and the prevailing situation is harsh, but there's no force in the world that can block the revolutionary advance of our party, army, and people that are moving forward under the wise leadership of great comrade Kim Jong-un. The North Korean regime was not shy about lionizing the youthful and inexperienced new leader. For Kim Jong-un, his father's funeral was the climax of a public succession that had begun in earnest just a few years before. the UK ambassador to Pyongyang reported that officials toasted Kim Jong-il and his son, the young general, at national events. Octogenarian elites bowed deeply in front of Kim Jong-un on state television. The regime not only touted the continuity from Kim to Kim, but also marketed the younger man as a reincarnation of his revered grandfather, down to the same dark suit and haircut, even girth. But it wasn't clear whether Kim Jong-un wanted the burden of being North Korea's leader. If the elites did not accept him, instability, mass defections, a flood of refugees, bloody purges, even a military coup could ensue. Would a brash, reckless, untethered Kim wield his newfound power, including an inherited nuclear arsenal, in a fit of military adventurism? Was his goal to dominate North Korea's policy and behavior? Or would he be more open to eliciting counsel from those around him? Asia watchers predicted Kim's imminent fall, overthrow, or demise. North Korea, as we know it, is over. Whether it comes apart in the next few weeks or over several months, the regime will not be able to hold together. Surely someone in his mid-20s with no leadership experience would be quickly overwhelmed and usurped by his elders. There was no way that North Koreans would stand for a second dynastic succession, unheard of in communism, not to mention that his youth was a critical demerit in a society that prizes the wisdom that comes with age and maturity. North Korea was poor and isolated, unable to feed its people. Even if Kim did manage to hold on to his position by clinging to the country's nuclear and missile programs for legitimacy and prestige, the collapse of North Korea seemed more likely than ever. As Kim solemnly marched alongside his father's hearse, he was accompanied by a ring of senior party and military officials, the so-called Gang of Seven. Their prestigious role in the funeral and symbolic placement around the new successor suggested that Kim Jong-un had the support of the old guard and the status quo would continue. Most experts saw these seven regime veterans as probable mentors for the young leader, at least for the near future, and some predicted an evolution of the Kim family's personality cult. Kim Jong-un would be a figurehead, and these regents would eventually call the shots in North Korea. That was then. In the ensuing years, Kim would use the mechanisms of authoritarian control, repression and fear, co-optation of elites, and control of military and security forces to consolidate his power and bolster the personality cult that had girded the legitimacy of his grandfather and his father as the sole leaders of North Korea. But Kim was not satisfied with simply maintaining this inherited infrastructure of control. In the journal Asian Perspectives, Patrick McEachern, an analyst in the U.S. State Department and an astute observer of North Korea, details how Kim centralized his power by reducing the institutional roles of the military and cabinet and placing the Korean Workers' Party under his singular leadership. Within the first 2 years of his reign, Kim purged, executed, demoted, and otherwise removed or marginalized five of the Gang of Seven, while jealously assuming key leadership positions himself. His innate flexibility and adaptability were in evidence as he sharpened his tools of coercion, using new technologies, cyber, and old, chemical and biological weapons, muscularly pressing forward to thrust North Korea into its place in the world as a nuclear-armed power capable of potentially striking the United States. Despite the enormous influence that Kim Jong-un exerts over current geopolitics and the danger he poses to global security, most people know next to nothing about him. Fascination with North Korea has sparked a deluge of articles, documentaries, and expert interviews to meet the demands of a public hungry for information about the young dictator who dominates the news cycle, as well as interpretation of his actions. Unfortunately, most of the accounts and reporting are simplistic, lacking deep analysis and understanding of the historical and geopolitical contexts. The wonky Washington speak of national security ignores both Kim's individuality and style, and North Korean culture and politics, as if Kim's personality, perceptions, and preferences do not matter
Sample complete. Ready to continue?